Welcome back to Bitcoin for Advisors. I'm your host, Morgan Richard, and with me I have the most important host, Pierre Richard.
Well, I don't know. Thanks for having me on. I feel like more like a guest on your podcast.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Well, maybe today I could be the guest and you could be the host.
Sounds good. Welcome to Bitcoin for Advisors. I'm your host, Pierre Richard, and I've got here is my guest, Morgan Richard.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me on. Happy to be here.
Welcome. We're glad to have you back. People keep asking for you to come back as our guest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm very happy that you've had me back on.
You always deliver. So you've got great content, and we need to hear all about Bitcoin for Advisors.
That sounds great. Yeah. So today's content will probably be a little different than some of the other content. It'll be actually directed towards Bitcoin for Advisors, like the title of our podcast denotes. But before we get into that, why don't we talk about some of the legislation that's floating out in the air?
Yes. So I think the one that caught everyone's attention was that Senator Lummis from the great state of Wyoming proposed legislation. One part of it would make it so that you can spend up to $600 of Bitcoin and not have to worry about the capital gains nonsense around that.
I mean, that sounds good to me.
Yes, absolutely. Although if you have a loss, maybe you don't want to take the loss.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if the government doesn't share in the burden of your losses, then they're certainly not going to help you with the gains too.
That's right.
Is that the way it goes?
That's the way it goes.
Yeah, I guess. So my question was, is it only for the Lightning Network or if it's just spending any Bitcoin, $600 or less?
I think it's any Bitcoin. I think it might be any crypto asset.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Go spend your Ethereum before it becomes worthless.
Yes. Although it's very expensive. It's very high transaction fees on Ethereum. So I don't know that you would want to use that for your walking around money.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Anyway, this is not Ethereum for Advisors. So I think it's a good step in the right direction. I think that Bitcoin should always be tax-free, no matter what the amount is. But we'll get there eventually.
Yeah, I'm wondering, like, the $600 number seems to be something that Congress is very focused on. I'm wondering why that's just a... why they seem to hone in on 600.
Also, how much is $600 going to be worth next month?
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, if inflation really is 8 or 10% or whatever.
Like, here's your $600 coffee, sir.
Yeah.
Like, I used up my entire IRS limitation with my coffee purchase.
But it does, I mean, it would make it more useful, right? I mean, I feel like I'm kind of in a place where if I do want to spend my Bitcoin for something, I just go and buy some and then go send it somewhere because I don't want to take from my actual stack.
Right. But that, I guess that wouldn't really, I mean, this legislation wouldn't really solve that, right?
I'd probably still do that because I'm a hoarder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you're, and here's the argument you'll hear on Twitter is, if you're able to spend fiat instead of spending Bitcoin, that means you're not all in on Bitcoin. That means you're not a real Bitcoiner, and that you should be ashamed of yourself.
I see. Yeah. So because I have some fiat, I should be ashamed of myself.
Yes. Whenever you receive fiat, you should immediately convert it into Bitcoin, and then convert it back into fiat only when you spend it.
I see. But that would be very difficult, right? Because given the world I live in today, right? Like our mortgage company doesn't accept Bitcoin as payment.
Well, you shouldn't have a mortgage. You should live in a RV.
Right. Got it. Oh, yeah. You remember when we were on our way to the racetrack and we saw those houses for 90K? Was it 90K?
90K, yeah.
90K, new house.
Yeah, it's very tempting.
Yeah, we should sell everything and go move there.
Yeah. I mean, I've told people to sell everything and go live under a bridge, but this is more realistic of living in a trailer home.
Mm-hmm. It was actually, it looked kind of nice from the highway.
The fact that you can see it from the highway might be problematic.
I know. I was thinking that too while I was going by. I was like, it's probably pretty loud over there. But people had lawns. Like, they were green.
Yeah. Okay. Well, those might have been weeds from far away.
That's true, too.
Because it's not really the season for a green lawn.
You're right,
Your lawn's
yeah.
supposed to be dormant right now.
Yeah, so. I bet. And I should think know it might have been picking all of our weeds.
Thick weeds.
Yeah, you're probably right. Okay. Well, you know, it's like a Monet. From far away, it looks nice. And then when you get up close, you're like, oh, that's why it's only 90K.
The Monet? Yes. Yeah. Okay, so now we're completely off track. But yeah, so you're supposed to be 100% in Bitcoin so that you have to spend Bitcoin, but that's impractical because, you know, most people have dollar obligations, dollar debts still.
Yeah.
But one day you could imagine that that won't be the case, and then you can be 100% in Bitcoin.
So what the legislation would do is basically say, even in that, I guess they would have to do a Bitcoin amount, though, not a dollar amount.
Well, in this hypothetical world, I don't think the dollar exists. So I yeah. don't think that you would pay any taxes on Bitcoin.
Yeah, there wouldn't be legislation. It just would be. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess anything helps in moving the ball forward for sure.
Because like when inflation is 10%, you should be allowed to deduct your dollar losses from inflation, right? You lost purchasing power. You realized the loss when you spent your dollars. And now you need to file a claim. And the person who profited is Janet Yellen and Jeremy Powell.
Yeah. Well, I was also kind of wondering, are they going to update all the numbers? Like, are the tax brackets all going to go up? Are, like, the amount you can put in retirement, is that going to go up too?
Yeah, they don't really...
Social Security cost of living adjustment, they're going to do that. I mean,
well, that's automatic.
Yeah.
Right? The Social Security cost of living adjustment. That's automatic, but...
But they don't ever give 8%. I mean, they normally give like 0.3%.
Yeah, yeah. They look at whatever item has gone up the least is mm-hmm. the benchmark. But yeah, the tax brackets are not automatically adjusted. And so it is certainly like... It's triple taxation, quadruple taxation, because you pay your income tax, mm-hmm. and then you pay the sales tax, mm-hmm. and you pay the inflation tax, and now you have to pay higher income tax because your income is going to go up, but your purchasing power is going to be the same.
Yep. Down.
Your purchasing power is going to go down.
I would imagine that your income... That well, I guess I'm hoping
consumer
that income,
prices yeah. and your salary are going up equally, right? So mm-hmm. your purchasing power is staying the same. Then your real tax liability is increasing. If you know, you're paying more taxes.
Yeah, for sure. I just wonder if anyone is actually going to get that income boost the way that they're going to see the cost of consumer goods go up.
Probably not. Certainly not. Yeah. I mean, I've never had an employment contract that had an automatic inflation adjustment yeah. to it. And then you're like going to your boss and you're like, hey, so I need a 20% raise for inflation mm-hmm. and then a 10% raise for my extraordinary performance this quarter. And then the boss is like, you want a 30% raise?
Yeah.
We're getting squeezed right now. Yeah, it's the inflation always puts employees in a bad negotiating position relative to employers. And the reverse is true for deflation. Mm-hmm. So deflation, the employers have to come to the employees and they're like, hey, look, we've got to cut your salary. But the good news is your purchasing power increased. But the bad news is we've got to cut your salary. So please bear with us. And that's why... big companies and, you know, companies of any size, employers, generally favor inflation over deflation. And that's probably contributes to why we're in this situation.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a harder conversation to tell somebody you're going to cut their salary, but they're better off.
Well, in practice, what happens is that the salary stays the same or increases a little bit because the value of the worker increased over that year anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's only in a world where the worker spent all year and did not become any more productive and did not learn any skills and your profit margins are, you know, getting squeezed by deflation where you'd have to come to them and be like, hey, we need to lower your salary, which, you know, should be a sign to the worker that hey, you really need to improve your performance.
Well, I think, though, then it well, something I think about a lot is, so you know how, like, they'll say, oh, like, the older work, the workforce, the more expensive it is type of thing. And then they don't take into account the fact that the older the workforce, generally, the more they know about the job and what they're doing. So you think, like, oh, I could just hire fresh talent for cheaper. But yeah. In a deflationary world, it's actually, it's a disadvantage.
Yes.
People who have been around and who know more and who are wise may retain jobs more easily.
I think so. And kids are incompetent. They need to be mentored and apprenticed.
Yeah, that is true. That's definitely true. Our kids certainly can use some our young kids.
Oh yes.
Kind of reminds me of when you left me with Alex and the farming simulator game.
Yes.
We got stuck on a fence, and I guess, like, at my age, I'm actually still incompetent at video games, so.
Well, we can practice that, but yeah, if you try to jump the fence with the tractor, it's going to get stuck.
Yeah, it's not Grand Theft Auto for farming.
No, it's a simulator.
Is there any other legislation out there that we wanted to talk about?
Well, we occasionally see people talk about Bitcoin as a legal tender. Uh-huh. And adding it to legal tender laws. And I've seen a lot of debate over whether making Bitcoin legal tender actually has any practical effect. Because kind of what I think is kind of the most absurd argument for legal tender is that people think that it forces merchants to accept Bitcoin. And so, you know, if you make Bitcoin legal tender, then you can walk into a McDonald's and you can, you know, be like, hey, I need to see your manager if you're not going to accept my Bitcoin. Mm. Which is not the case. I mean, that's not what legal tender means. And also, you know, it's not a great way to get Bitcoin adoption.
No,
force people to use it. Although, you know, there's some debate there. I could come up with arguments for why we should force people to use Bitcoin. But anyway, the other one is that making it legal tender would automatically make it so that it is tax-free.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the case from what I've heard from the lawyers and the accountants. Although, you know, I'm not a lawyer, not an accountant. you know, if you're passing a legal tender law, definitely consult your experts there. but what I do think is valuable about them is kind of symbolic, that you're basically saying, we're not going to ban Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And you're saying it, you know, in law. And I think that's hugely valuable, because people talk about the regulatory uncertainty. And they're worried about governments banning Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And so if your government comes out and says, not only are we not going to ban Bitcoin, but we're going to make it legal tender, and it distances it from a ban. The other part that's important for legal tender laws with Bitcoin is that it starts the conversation, and it starts the education process with lawmakers.
Yeah.
So it leads naturally to the question of, well, what is Bitcoin? Why do we want to make it legal tender? Let's study Bitcoin. Let's figure out how it works. And that naturally leads to, you know, more understanding, more knowledge of Bitcoin, and then better policy ideas. Like, maybe we should start accumulating Bitcoin as a government, or we should make it completely tax-free, or we should have incentives for Bitcoin mining in our jurisdiction. And so I think that it's good it's a good way to open up the conversation.
Yeah, for sure. I think that the government itself, though, has some kind of conflict of interest right now, right? Where they might not want to be friendly towards anything from a tax perspective because of the debt.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depends who in government, because one of the great things about government is that nobody wants to take responsibility for anything when they're in government. And so if nobody wants to take responsibility for defending the credit of the nation, then the credit of the nation will go to junk. And that's good from my point of view, right? That it's a tragedy of the commons. Mm-hmm. And we've seen plenty of countries go down that route where they trash their debt, they trash their currency in order to achieve some other goal.
Yeah.
And if they do it to achieve some other goal of just, you know, holding on to power or going to war, that's bad. But if the other goal is, hey, we're switching to the Bitcoin standard, then I think that's good. You're going to have a end up with a good outcome.
We definitely have enough of a reserve here in the U.S. if we don't sell what we've seized.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I think that money should be given back to all of the people who were using Silk Road. but that might be too much to ask for, given that they were all trying to be pseudonymous.
Yeah.
It might be hard to find them.
Yep, for sure.
Maybe the NSA knows who they are.
The NSA probably does know.
Yeah. But the NSA is like, nah, we're not giving that money back.
Yeah. They're like, we don't actually know.
Or they'll be like, yeah, you know, they all happen to be employees of the NSA.
They might actually be there.
Yeah, they were all feds. It was actually, the only non-fed on the Silk Road was Ross Ulbricht. Oops. Free Ross, get him out of jail.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then there was a law that got attention in Europe.
Mm.
The EU wanted to not only ban Bitcoin mining, but also ban the trading of Bitcoin.
Oh.
Because it's not environmentally friendly.
Right, yeah.
And it's funny because the law was written such that it said, you either have to be environmentally friendly or have a roadmap towards environmental friendliness.
Okay.
And so people were freaking out about, oh, this law is going to ban Bitcoin. And my reaction was, why don't we just have a roadmap to environmental friendliness?
Yeah.
Doesn't mean we have to do it.
I mean, governments have that all the time.
Yeah, and Ethereum has had that for 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's true, yeah.
So what's the difference between having it for 8 years or 80 years or 800 years?
It's
just a difference.
I think at some point they become impatient, but hopefully by then the turnover has been such that
They would have to change the law.
Yeah.
If they get impatient, they got to change the law and have, like, by this date, you have to be environmentally friendly. That's not how they wrote the law. They said you've got to have a plan in place.
Yeah, there you go.
And anyone can go on GitHub and post a plan of, here's how we're going to make Bitcoin, you know, proof of stake over the next millennia. And
yeah,
then
you have a plan.
Then they've fulfilled the requirements of the law.
Is that what lawmakers think makes something environmentally friendly if there's no proof of work?
Yeah, basically.
It's interesting, though, that, like, that's what's come into question, because that's the thing that makes Bitcoin the what it is.
The most secure network, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the other thing is that I would actually suggest that if we don't change anything about Bitcoin, it will become environmentally friendly, because all else equal, with each halving, the amount of electricity consumption gets cut in half.
Hmm.
So every 4 years, Bitcoin becomes more environmentally friendly.
That's an interesting thought. I hadn't thought about it like that.
And eventually it goes to zero, and then it's only the transaction fees that are causing electricity consumption. And, you know, we have a plan for getting transaction fees to be very low as well. So eventually maybe the electricity costs will be even lower than what it is today, despite a Bitcoin value being much higher.
Mm. 2140 is not that far away either. I feel like you just came up with the plan.
Yeah, I did. You're right. You're right. Actually, you know what?
You should send this.
It was a tempest in a teapot. People were making a mountain out of a molehill, because this legislation could have passed, and I would have gladly, you know, flown to Europe and testified that as the CEO of Bitcoin, I have put in place a plan.
There you go.
It's called the halvings. and everyone's behind it. All the Bitcoiners love this plan.
That's true, actually. All the Bitcoiners do love this plan.
Yeah.
You have 100% support.
Yeah. And we're going to get there very quickly, too, because, you know, there's 2140, which is like the last Satoshi. Mm-hmm. But really, I mean, you're looking at like 2030 to really get to a very low number, because I think that in the 2030s, 99% of Bitcoin will have been mined.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We're going to reach levels of scarcity previously unknown. Well, technically, we're already there.
Yeah, I feel like we're already there.
Because Bitcoin's stock to flow, you know, I know people talk about stock to flow, but it's better than gold's. Mm-hmm. As of the last halving.
Do you want to explain what stock to flow is?
Yeah, so stock to flow is basically the ratio between how many Bitcoin are out there already versus how many Bitcoin are being added to the ledger. So the stock is how many Bitcoin are already owned by people, mm-hmm. and the flow is how many Bitcoin are being mined and added to the system.
Yeah.
And so the higher the stock to flow ratio, the more scarce an asset is.
I see.
The lower the stock to flow ratio. So like, for example, oil probably, I mean, it should have a stock to flow ratio of like 1-to-1. Mm-hmm. Assuming nobody's hoarding oil, which at this point...
Some people are. Yeah.
But if it's just flowing directly from the oil field through the refinery into your gas tank, it's 1-to-1. But with gold or Bitcoin, you get a much higher ratio.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. There was also that legislation, the executive order on Biden's desk.
Yeah, that turned out to kind of be very empty because, you know, it's one of those things where they want to have the government study it. So it's like, hey, we want to form a committee that's going to issue some recommendations. And it's like, well, this is not...
They can't do anything without a committee.
Yeah. It's not... It's
unbelievable.
It's not something we have to worry about anytime soon. And I heard that it actually got watered down. Hmm. That it started out a little more aggressive, and then the industry people got involved and were like, this is unnecessarily aggressive. Like, you haven't even studied the issue. And I've noticed this... Even in the private sector, when you don't want somebody to do something, tell them that they need to write a memo about it and that they need to do a study and they need to gather data.
Yeah, there you go.
That's how you slow things down. Mm-hmm. Come
take
up the
can somewhere.
Yeah.
Oh, that guy's studying it over there. We'll wait until we hear from him.
Yeah. And then years pass.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, what'd you find? We need to do some further research.
Oh, okay.
It's inconclusive right now.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that by the time they come out with their study, they probably won't control the House anymore, and they might not control the Senate. They probably still will control the presidency.
Yeah. Assuming, we'll see.
Yeah, nothing happens. But... if the study takes a very long time, you know, we might have President DeSantis and then they would like throw away the study because they'd be like, well, we don't care about what the Democrats did.
Yeah, it's kind of it's a gift and a curse, right? The shortcomings of the system.
the founding fathers, I think they were very wise in how they created the checks and balances. Even though we're kind of far from that, it's still...
Yeah, remains. But what it always seems to me is that when they don't get anything done, on the one hand, I'm glad that they didn't get anything done because I don't want them to do anything. But on the other hand, you're like, you just wasted everyone's time, money. Like, talk about like wasting electricity and being non-environmentally friendly, right? It's like, I mean, they're doing nothing. And they're spending a lot of energy to do nothing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, eventually...
But I want them to do nothing, so I feel, like, conflicted by that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why, I mean, it's important to make sure the dollar goes to zero so then they can stop printing it to fund stupid studies.
Yeah. There we go. Did we miss any legislation? Anything else that came through?
No, I think that's pretty much it.
Those
off
the highlights.
Top of yes. Oh, you know, I'll mention another piece of legislation that I think is really interesting, which is the Keep Your Coins Act.
What's this?
It's from Warren Davidson.
Okay,
he's a congressman from Ohio, and it basically says that no government agency in the U.S. can ban you from holding your own Bitcoin, from having your own private keys.
Oh, that's awesome.
It is. And the reason it's necessary is because the people who are promoting this anti-money laundering system want to prevent people from holding their own Bitcoin, because once you let people hold their own Bitcoin, then it kind of exits the surveillance system that they have in place,
and they can do bad things with it. And that's what they always say: oh, if you have money that we're not surveying, then where you are going to do bad things with it.
Yeah, and they want to freeze the accounts, and mm-hmm. they want to be able to, you know, intervene. So they would be correct if we lived in a totalitarian society like China.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of dystopian, hey, the government ultimately controls everything about your life. We're trying to work towards something else, which is a free society.
Oh, okay.
Where, you know, the government actually has to prove that you committed a crime.
Beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah. By a due process where you can defend yourself.
No way.
And face your accuser, rather than just having your bank account turned off. And they don't like that.
No, so, yeah, I could see that.
So this act would kind of help prevent them from really getting totalitarian.
Do you think it'll gain traction?
I hope so. I think that it will gain traction when the Republicans control the House and thus control the committees,
mm-hmm.
because I think the Democrats would look at an act like that and say, we do want to be able to freeze people's accounts.
Yeah, Well, also, and in the name of bad actors, we want to be able to freeze everyone's accounts.
Right. I mean, they'll never say that. And the crazy part is that it's just as likely to get turned on them, right? And mm-hmm. so if, you know, Trump gets reelected, and maybe I use a different example than Trump.
Yeah.
If somebody that is a Republican but does not respect, you know, freedom, they could freeze the bank accounts of progressive activists.
Yeah.
And so that could get turned around on the left just as easily. And so they should be really cautious about creating this surveillance system.
Well, that's why you want to play nice, even when you're in office.
Yeah, you got to set up a system where, and this in philosophy, there's kind of John Rawls. He talks about, if you didn't know who you're going to be in society, what would you make the rules be?
Mm.
So you've kind of got to think about the lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
Of, all right, well, if I was like the poorest person here and the least powerful person, what would I want the laws to be like? And then with that, if I was the most powerful person and the wealthiest person, would I be happy with those laws as well, right? Because
yeah,
it goes both ways.
Yeah.
And that's how you should set up the system. But politicians don't think that way. Generally, they think about, okay, I'm in power now,
mm-hmm.
so I want to exercise power.
Yep.
And I don't really care about the long-term consequences.
And I also promised my constituents X, Y, and Z.
And my donors.
Yeah. Well, yes. My donors, specifically. I would say less about constituents.
Depends. Sometimes. Depends. You know, it's interesting.
If you need the votes, then yeah.
Right. Sometimes the votes are more important than the money. Sometimes the money is more important mm-hmm. than the votes.
Yeah. It depends where you are in the voting cycle.
Yep. Yep.
It's kind of sad.
Well, I mean,
I don't know what else to say.
we can get into democracy versus monarchy. But,
yeah, maybe another topic. Day. Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, would you like to talk about how to implement Bitcoin in an advisory practice?
Yeah, I think all the advisors have turned it off.
But, yeah, by now they're like, ugh, these people.
Yeah. okay, so I've got a lot of questions for you.
Okay.
So let's say I have a financial planning practice. I've never done anything related to Bitcoin or crypto. It's just, you know, your traditional fiat money management. What's the first step?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say the first step is that you have to get educated on what the asset class is. And that's easier said than done. We've talked about it on this podcast quite a bit. I would go back and actually re-listen to all of our episodes about what Bitcoin is and why it's different from crypto. I would specifically listen. We had two episodes on altcoins that will help you differentiate between what Bitcoin is versus what everything else in the space is. There are some good books that we had mentioned on the last podcast that I would suggest that advisors read. So the first one is definitely the Bitcoin Standard, I would say, is something that would be good to read. I haven't read Layered Money yet, but I have it sitting on my on my tower of books, and I've heard extremely good things about that one. I've read Why Buy Bitcoin, and that one's pretty good, too. I'm interested in hearing what your list would be for advisors as well on like what could be sort of a non-technical way for them to get access to Bitcoin. The Satoshi Nakamoto Institute has a really good archive of articles, and I actually point people there all the time. It's called the Mempool, and there's a lot of really talented people who have written really great articles that are on there going back to 2012 or 2013. Maybe even earlier.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it includes all of the writings from Satoshi. So, but even before Satoshi, it includes kind of, the predecessors of, Satoshi in there as well.
Yeah. So. They're all still relevant though, which is what I found kind of interesting when I went back recently and was reading some of those articles. Even the ones where you would think, oh, it's topical to 2014. It's still incredibly relevant today, which I think is actually a testament to what Bitcoin is and why it's important and why it's here to stay. So that's really step one. I mean, I think it's really easy as an advisor who has nothing to do with this space and doesn't want to have anything to do with this space, but has clients asking questions and has been dismissing it as something that they shouldn't be looking at. Before you say, no way, Jose, maybe just read a little bit first and see whether or not this is something that is appropriate for you. And at the very least, know enough so that you can hold a conversation with the client. Because if they're coming to you to talk about it, you're their first line of questioning, right? They trust you the most about their money. So where better to go to talk about money than with somebody like an advisor? And they already have their trust in you. So all you need to do is just make sure that you can speak clearly on the subject, whether positively or negatively.
Absolutely. And I think the other challenge might be that the clients know more than the advisor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Or think they know more.
Or maybe they even do know more, right? But I think that it, as an advisor, it could be kind of embarrassing sometimes if you get a question that you don't know an answer to. And the way I've handled that through the years of my practice is I literally say, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that. Let me get back to you. Let me look into it and get back to you. We say that to clients all the time. Like, I just had something really random pop up on a disability policy. I don't know every little detail about disability policies, but does that mean that I should give an off-the-cuff answer? No, it means I should go research it. It's like anything else in your practice, right? You don't know every single little tax law. You probably don't know to the dollar every single tax bracket. No one expects you to know every little thing about Bitcoin. So if but you should know enough to be able to hold a conversation and then know your limits to say, I need to look into that more so I can properly answer your question.
Absolutely. Maybe the easiest book to read is from my friend Skylar, Reasons to Buy Altcoins.
Oh, yeah. It's a great book. I learned a lot.
Full disclosure, the pages are blank. No, yeah, I think you named some great books there. I think that, you know, there's also now the Fiat Standard.
Oh yeah, the Fiat Standard.
Which, I think is also really great reading, because a lot of the, in my mind, kind of the objection I would have to Bitcoin is, okay, this might be a good Ponzi scheme, but what is its purpose? The why? Like, why does it exist? Other than the fact, like, because you can talk about, like, oh, it has the highest Sharpe ratio, and so you're going to, you know, it's good for your portfolio, and you're going to make money off it. Because, you know, and that's different than the fundamental question of, is this good for society? Is this good for me as, like, kind of a phenomenon? Mm-hmm. Or is this just a financial investment like any other?
I think falling back on things like the Sharpe ratio specifically, or looking at past returns, is going to make it, if that's your only case for why you're putting this in client portfolios, it's going to be really hard to hold through tough times. And if anyone's looked at a chart of Bitcoin, there are a lot of tough times. There's irrationally exciting times on the upside, but there's also long periods of rough times, especially if you allocate it towards the top. So I guess I wouldn't use that, and I never use that in my practice. The way we talk about it is like an asset class that we are intending to hold for an extremely long period of time. And so it's like any other asset class that you would hold for an extremely long period of time. You need to know why you're holding it, and therefore can stomach the periods of time that are not going to be very comfortable.
Right. Right. Now, then the next part is, after you're kind of educated on the fundamentals of Bitcoin, the why of it, then the big question is, I think the first one would be the allocation percentage.
I think there's a step in between, okay, which is like, what purpose does this have in my practice? And I think that one's often skipped. I think people are like, okay, once I am educated on Bitcoin, then I will, how do I allocate it? Like, how do I make this happen? And I think that sort of, it loses sight of kind of how we think about things in general that we help clients with, right? Like, there are some advisors who only manage assets, right? There are some advisors who are more are planning focused, like my practice. And it's like, okay, we plan anything that we understand and can help plan with, right? And then we also know where there are limitations to what we can do, right? We don't provide estate planning. I'm not an attorney. So I think that seeing where this specifically fits in your practice is kind of important before you start thinking about an allocation. If you're an advisor who is investment focused only, the way you implement that is probably going to be very different than somebody who is planning focused, right? Who has maybe a different reach with their clients, maybe charges a little bit differently, maybe doesn't charge just assets under management based, has potentially a different relationship with their clients, is talking about multiple different facets of their portfolio. And I think that it could be a gateway to say maybe you want to make changes in your practice, right? If this is something that's really important to you and you've educated yourself and you're like, okay, actually, this is the future of money, then how can I best help clients implement this? Whether that be just a percentage of their portfolio, or something where we are actually educating them to eventually hold their own private keys.
Right. And then if you work at a traditional financial institution,
mm-hmm. It's not going to happen. You have to start thinking about leaving.
You got to join the committee that's going to study the.
Yeah, exactly. Topic. Exactly. I mean, I'm actually, maybe I'm so far removed from that world that I just don't know, honestly. I mean, I imagine if you're at like a Morgan Stanley or Merrill Lynch, you can allocate to things like Riot Blockchain or Mara or like.
Right. Because they're just equities.
Yeah.
But you're not.
I don't think, though, that you'll I doubt that you're in a position to help clients actually own their own private keys. And I don't think that that's a goal of the Morgan Stanleys and the Merrill Lynches of the world.
Maybe Fidelity.
Yeah, I think Fidelity. I think, though, you have to be pretty high net worth in order to get access to their Bitcoin product.
This is why the rich get richer.
Yeah. I think that Fidelity hasn't figured out how to scale that product yet. And that's why they're only offering it. I forget what the net worth, or not net worth, the assets requirement was, but I remember it being high. Maybe they've changed that since I looked at it. But yeah, from there, then I would discuss like, well, then it's like, okay, meet with the client and talk to the client, right? Because the allocation per client is probably going to be very different. And I think that this is where like sort of the independent shops who don't use models have an advantage over the shops that do. Because like when we look at client portfolios, nobody's in a model because that's just not how we do it. Everyone kind of has their own allocation and it's not scalable. Like, I'm the first to admit that our practice isn't scalable. So for a practice who, you know, does put people in models, then yeah, I guess you have to decide, okay, everyone in this model is going to get 5% or whatever. But really how we do it is based on like client interaction. How well they understand the technology is pretty important. Somebody who understands it better and who is excited about it and wants to use it and is interested in Bitcoin the way you and I are, right, is going to have a very different allocation than somebody who, you know, is in a nursing home maybe, or is, you know, anti-tech, or I don't know. There's a number of reasons why maybe you wouldn't want to have as high of an allocation for somebody just based on their understanding. And then you have to look at the actual client's risk tolerance as well, like how we would standardly think of risk tolerance. But I think that that understanding part of it is not something that we really think about as much when we talk about stock and bond portfolios. I think because stocks and bonds have been around for so long, there's sort of like, even though clients maybe don't totally understand what a stock or a bond is, there's just some sort of familiarity with it because they've been around for so long. Whereas with Bitcoin, that's not something that you can take that you can kind of take lightly. I feel like, you know, the client education part and actually realizing what it is that the client can accept is more important in that regard.
Right. That makes sense. And the client might be like, hey, I want to go all in on Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Or they might be like, well, I hear what you're saying. I've done some education, but frankly, I think this is a scam.
Yeah.
0%.
You know what? And that's their right. I think that's kind of the other thing. I think it's easy for me as an advisor who's really into Bitcoin to be like, everyone should have Bitcoin. And I know this is something that's tossed around in the communities a lot, but everyone gets the price that they deserve. It's true, right? It's like, it sometimes takes people just a really long time to get around to it. And, you know, I got a higher price buying Bitcoin than when I first heard about it. I like, you know, it kind of scared me to send money over to Japan without an account number when I looked at Mt. Gox. So like, yeah, I didn't buy it at $2 and that's okay. Yeah, exactly. But I feel like, you know, I think that having some empathy as an advisor is something that we do all the time. And have a little empathy for people in this regard too. Just because you've gone down the rabbit hole and you're super excited about Bitcoin doesn't mean your clients have.
Right. And maybe even it, but it also, even if they are very negative on it day zero, they might change their mind because mm-hmm. you've incepted the idea in their heads. And especially, you know, when Bitcoin goes up, then they feel that fear of missing out. When it goes down, sometimes they think, oh, well, maybe it's at a discount.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe this is the dip that I'm going to enter in. Yeah.
Yeah, or I'm smarter than my advisor because I didn't allocate when they told me to.
Yeah,
and I didn't lose 25%. Yeah. there's something too, though, the inception idea. So it was Jordan Peterson, actually, that I heard this from, but I'm sure he got it from some study. It was about people who had fear of elevators. And he had people basically, if they had fear of elevators, where you would look at a picture of an elevator until they didn't feel scared anymore. And then they would go and visit an elevator, but they wouldn't go inside or go near it. They would just like look at an elevator from afar. And then they would get closer and closer to that elevator until one day they actually stepped inside the elevator, but they didn't ride it. They just stepped inside. And then they allowed the doors to close, but they didn't ride it, you know, and so forth until they were like, okay, I'm ready to go to the top floor of this building. And that's how they handled it. And then they didn't have a fear of elevators anymore.
And then the elevator malfunctioned and crashed. And they died. And they're like, Jordan Peterson.
Oh, that's not what happened, at least in his story. But I guess that's possible. Now everyone's going to have a fear of elevators again.
Yeah, yeah.
But
stay away from elevators, folks. Don't listen to Jordan Peterson.
I feel like Bitcoin's kind of like that, even though you just scrapped all over my point.
Okay.
Most elevators are safe. And so, like, I feel like Bitcoin exposure is one of those things, though, where you hear about it enough. And at some point, you're like, okay, maybe I want to learn about this a little bit more. And then you start learning about it. And if you pull the right threads, the next thing you know, you're down the rabbit hole, so to speak.
Yeah. And to continue the analogy, the media is always going to talk about the elevator accidents. Mm-hmm. They're not going to write a story about all the successful elevator trips.
They're boring.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're following Bitcoin just by reading the news, you are getting the same point of view that you would get if you followed elevators just by reading the news.
Yes, definitely. But as somebody told me about Bitcoin, I think maybe it was even you, that all press is good press.
Yeah.
Again, it's exposure, right?
It's exposure. I guess so. I mean, yeah, I don't know.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe not. But yeah, I mean, I think so. I have a client actually who did not want to allocate to Bitcoin, and we had a back and forth about it. And what it turned out to be was that that client was just not open to the idea of Bitcoin at that time. And I think that that's something that advisors who are in the throes of Bitcoin and are really excited about it and want everybody to have it to sort of acknowledge that, hey, like, they're just not open to it today. But that doesn't mean that I shouldn't bring it up in the future. And that doesn't mean that we won't have, you know, better conversations about it sometime down the line.
Okay, so for the ones who are ready to dip their toes and but they're hesitant, mm-hmm. and it's very unknown, you know, you start at 1%.
Yeah. So the rule we use within the practice right now, but it's actually been sort of creeping up higher, has been 1-10% of net worth based on all the factors that we've talked about, which is risk tolerance, understanding of the technology, time horizon, ability really to take risk versus willingness, things that we've mentioned on this podcast before. But I think that, you know, with the caveat of, okay, maybe that's the initial allocation, but maybe then we also talk about what rebalancing looks like. Because if it does work out really well, your client maybe could then have, you know, a much higher than 10% position if that's where you started, in which case you need to decide, okay, at what point do I need to rebalance this? And that's the subsequent conversation you need to have with that client. I think if you're starting at 1%, even you still need to have that conversation, right? A client who starts at 1% might feel uncomfortable at 3%. In which case, you know, maybe you don't think a 3% position is a big deal because it still falls between that 1-10%, you know, good ratio. But maybe 3% really is too much for that client. So that's why, like, I keep coming back to the idea that, like, that the advisors who have more bespoke portfolios for their clients are going to have an easier time with this because they're doing this all the time for all the asset classes anyways. Whereas if you're in a model, right, maybe all 100 people that you have in that model don't need to be rebalanced at 3%. Maybe only, you know, half of them do based on that client's risk tolerance and understanding. And then I guess the question also is how they are going to get access to Bitcoin, right? It's not just, okay, I'm dipping the toe and I'm talking about 1% allocation here or 10% or whatever you're going to do. It's okay, what are we actually buying for the client? Because, right, there's that futures ETF that's out that I think is kind of scammy. There's GBTC, which frankly has had all sorts of problems. And then there's actually buying Bitcoin. There's your client can go to a place like Coinbase, Kraken, Gemini, and go buy it themselves. And you actually send out money, which is hard for an advisor to do if they're an AUM-based advisor. But it's probably the right route where you literally have a call with the client and you say, okay, let's go set up your account. All right, today we're going to go buy it. Okay, I'm going to go show you how to do it, type of a thing. And then the other thing that could happen, though, when you do that is like, oh, a client sees that there's 700 other things that they can buy when they're in their Coinbase, Kraken, or Gemini account, right? And then they end up with other things in their account, even though you only wanted them to go buy Bitcoin. So there, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages to going down that route. There's also advisor products that have come out. There's four companies off the top of my head. So Swan has a Bitcoin-only product. Eagle Brook Advisors has Bitcoin and Ethereum in theirs. And Flourish, which I think is the banking product, and I'm actually not sure what they call their crypto product, so apologies there. But they have a product there as well that's Bitcoin and Ethereum. And then there's OnRamp that's like a... basically like sending your client to Coinbase to go buy because they can pretty much buy almost anything there. So, but you would do it for them. And that's a whole other conversation that I guess we can have today if you want to. But
yeah, I mean, there's also there's River that doesn't have. Well, I don't know if they have a financial advisor product per se, but just in terms of a Bitcoin only brokerage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, River does have a Bitcoin only brokerage.
And then there's all the kind of proxies, right? Of you could own a Bitcoin mining company, mm-hmm. equity in a Bitcoin mining company, or MicroStrategy debt.
Yep.
If you want to add to your bond portfolio.
I guess you can also hold MicroStrategy, but I don't know what percentage of their balance sheet is Bitcoin versus not.
It's essentially 100%.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
But I mean, you're also like, they have a business that they run too, don't they?
Yeah. Even, you know, with a pure Bitcoin mining company, there are additional risks mm-hmm. associated with it beyond, if you were just holding your own keys, risks relating to operational performance and management, et cetera. Also something I see it as actually like that you would have your physical Bitcoin, mm-hmm. right, with your own private keys allocation. And then you have, well, you know, kind of what do they call it? Smart beta.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got like S&P 500, but you also think that Bitcoin's going to do really well. And so you have a little, you know, side pocket of Bitcoin miners.
Mm-hmm. I see what you mean. Yeah, I think the thing why I like, let's say, doing something like a Swan or a Eaglebrook or whatever before you would, let's say, allocate to GBTC, even though it's like probably the easiest way. The easiest thing to do is to just have your client own GBTC or something like that, or even own some of the miners in your portfolio. The problem with, let's say, owning something like GBTC is one, I mean, the fees are incredibly high. It's been trading at a discount for a while. They're passing through expenses to their investors because they've actually had to sell assets from redemption. So there are some issues with that for sure. But like they don't get to take advantage of the tax loss harvesting loophole, which when you have holding a really volatile asset like Bitcoin and you can literally buy and sell in the same hour and take a loss. I mean, that's like one of the most exciting, freest lunches I think that are out there, other than the fact that you would have to pull your, if you had things in cold storage, you would have to pull them out to do it. But you can't obviously take advantage of that if you own GBTC because it is considered a standard asset rather than the cryptocurrency loophole. But if you did go down like a Swan route, right, you can help your client buy Bitcoin on their, like, help them buy it basically. And then when they're ready to self custody, they actually own Bitcoin and they can move it off that platform and hold it. So I think it's sort of like a nice way to sort of on ramp a client into eventually doing self custody, which I think should be the goal of most practices.
Right. Okay, so then with self-custody, how does that work?
Yeah, so I think that advisors are going to have trouble with this. Self-custody literally means that your client takes control of their assets. And if I don't know if anyone has clients that have like cash in their house, but most people don't, right?
Well, they have their house.
Yeah, they have their house, but like most people don't like have a bunch of money lying around their house, right? I mean, for the most part, things are in bank accounts, they're in investment houses, right? This is probably the first time that your client would ever have to, in any capacity, take control or take custody of a large sum of money potentially. So I think that like, making sure that your client is ready for that responsibility is the most important thing. Before, you know, like the worst thing you would want to have is that they take self-custody and they lose it. And also they're going to blame you probably if they do that. Is another thing to consider. So there are solutions, right? There are some clients who they understand it. They can do it. They can literally send their, you know, hold their own private keys in their house. And there are other clients who it's going to be a slower off-ramp into self-custody, and there are multi-sig solutions that can help with that. Like Unchained Capital comes to mind as maybe a good solution for clients where they can, you know, hold two of three, and that way if they lose one, Unchained Capital can help them recover their key and everything else. So that I would say is probably one of the better options for clients out there. That way, you know, they're taking custody, but they're not, you know,
There's also Casa.
Yep, Casa does that as well. Thank you.
So definitely research those two options. Yeah, I think that, you know, it's one thing to educate yourself about Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually might take you less time than educating yourself about self-custody.
Oh, totally.
Because there's so many factors to include in self-custody, including, you know, inheritance and issues like that.
We could probably do a whole episode on custody.
Yeah, maybe we should have someone from Unchained or Casa come on and help us out with that. Because, yeah. You know, it's a multifaceted problem and everyone's situation is unique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I think it's... the other thing, right, is like your client might be quick to say, okay, I can hold my own keys and then go put it in a safety deposit box at a bank. And like they need to be educated on maybe why they wouldn't want to do something like that.
Right. Yes. Because the bank might not give you access to the safety deposit box.
Mm-hmm.
They might give somebody else access to it. And you're kind of back to the old problem of the bank controls your money.
Yep. Exactly.
Okay, that's good. You mentioned rebalancing earlier, but you only mentioned the rosy scenario.
Mm.
What about when things go down a lot?
Mm, yeah. Well, I think that's also a discussion that you need to have with your client, right? Some clients are going to be excited about rebalancing in and buying more, and others are not. So, again, I think it's really, this is one of those things that because it's so volatile and because it's so new, it has to be done on a case-by-case basis. If that's not an option for you, though, then I would just set rules of, okay, hey, if it goes below this, you know, if let's say we have a 1% allocation. If it goes below 0.8%, then we buy more. If it goes above 1.2, then we rebalance, right? I think you might be rebalancing quite often if you have the guardrails be so tight, but you know, it's just an example of 20% moves on either side. So there's two ways to look at it. Three ways. The first way would be calendar rebalancing. Every year we take it back to a certain percentage, or quarter or month, whatever you decide as your period of time. The second one would be the guardrails where you say, okay, below this percentage or above that percentage. Obviously that takes more constant monitoring on the advisor's part. So that's something to consider, how much monitoring they want to be doing. And then the third thing would be setting it on a client by client basis where some clients are willing to rebalance and some clients are not. Generally, though, I would say that if you're going to set a percentage, depending on how you've discussed it with the client, right, it might make sense to add more if it goes down. It might not, depending on the client, but that, you know, the less rebalancing you're going to do is going to be better. I think that buying on the way down is obviously better for your client, but it might be physically unbearable for that client.
Catching knives.
Yeah. So something that might help your client withstand volatility over a long period of time is literally to buy it and forget about it and don't add to it, right? Because that might help them hold it over a longer period of time, which is how they're going to get better returns, not by catching knives on the way down.
That makes sense. Okay. So we talked about kind of the person who's going from 100% fiat to owning some Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
What about the opposite? The person who's 100% Bitcoin, and they might even think, I don't need a financial planner. What value do you have post-hyper-Bitcoinization? Why would anyone have a financial planner?
I love that question. I think there are certain aspects of financial planning that do not change regardless of how you hold your money. So the first thing is you've got income coming in and you've got expenses going out. Let's say, I don't know, in this extremely rosy scenario where you bought enough Bitcoin where you retire, you still have to manage your cash flows out, right? At some point you're going to be spending, if you're retired and you don't have any income coming in, right, then you need to be spending to sustain your life in some way or another. I mean, you can sort of control that, right, by, let's say, buying a piece of property and then only paying property taxes and having the rest of your costs. So, like, there are ways to sort of think about it. But then you have to think about, okay, does it make more sense for me to do that versus this, right? There's a lot of just little nitty-gritty financial planning questions that are going to come up. There's the not so rosy scenario, though, right, where you do own a lot of Bitcoin, but you aren't ready to retire, and maybe you want to make a change in what you do for a living. Maybe you want to use some of that Bitcoin to buy a business. Maybe you're not really sure the best scenario to go about doing that. Maybe you're thinking about lending against your Bitcoin. I would highly recommend, even though there's so many podcasts out there with people talking about lending against your Bitcoin. I mean,
borrowing against
your Bitcoin. Somebody lending to you. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's like nails on a chalkboard for me when I hear these podcasts of people who don't know anything about anybody's situations and are talking about how they can borrow against their Bitcoin. I think it makes people really excited that they can have their cake and eat it too, and that everything's going to work out well. I highly recommend talking to a financial planner before you do stuff like that. And actually working out what the cost is, at the very least, if you're not going to talk to a financial planner. There's estate considerations. My hope is that, you know, you bought enough Bitcoin that you have a lovely estate that you can leave to heirs or to charities or whatever it is that you want to do with all that money. Those are all things that you would probably want to talk to a planner about. Starting a business is another one that comes to mind. You might be 100% in Bitcoin and now you're ready to go, you know, take that Bitcoin and go invest it into a company, and you want to know what's appropriate for you in your situation.
Absolutely. Now, you could also talk about the life planning.
Yes. Yeah. So not all advisors do this, though. So there's a small select group of financial planners who do something that's called life planning. It's through the Kinder Institute. And it basically, what it does is it helps clients think about what's most important to them, prioritize it, and then execute on it. And I've personally have been through it. It's a fantastic program. We do it for clients in our practice, and we found that people just get very energetic and excited about the options that they have for themselves.
Excellent. And you know that it's perhaps even more necessary if you're 100% Bitcoin and you're doing really well for yourself to have good life planning in place.
Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean, I think that when you think about, right, I think that people end up, when you're 100% Bitcoin, right, you're kind of in a different realm. You're in, like, planning your life around Bitcoin, essentially, and doing Bitcoin things and being around Bitcoin people. And there's a lot that I think goes into that aspect of the community. And so I think prioritizing what's really important to you and making sure that you get those things done, they're important for anybody at any stage in their life, but it's especially important when you're in a position where, like, maybe money is no object for you anymore. How are you going to act in your life? How are you going to create new purpose, right? If your old purpose was to accumulate Bitcoin or find a way to have more income coming in, right? I think that sometimes we get really excited about the idea of retirement, but it actually removes like a carrot basically dangling in front of your face that makes you do things day in and day out. And once, for a lot of people, that carrot is removed, it makes it really difficult for them to actually accomplish the other things in their life that are important to them.
Hmm. Fascinating. Okay. Is there any big areas that we missed here?
Yeah. So I would say compliance is probably one of the bigger areas. How to be compliant is, I think, probably the number one question I've gotten from advisors on this. For starters, it helps to have your compliance person, or if you are the head of compliance, to be on board with this and figuring out how to do this in a compliant way. Do not take custody of anybody's Bitcoin, right? That would obviously trigger the custody rules of RIAs, and then you'd have to, you know, go through spot checks and audits and all sorts of other things on an annual basis that are costly. So I would say steer clear of that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't help people with Bitcoin. And I think that I think the compliance risks are hugely overstated, because basically Bitcoin is not a security. It's been said by the SEC that it's not a security. So yes, like investing your client in something like GBTC is a security. Investing your clients in Bitcoin miners that are, you know, publicly traded Bitcoin mining companies, yes, those are securities. But Ethereum might be a security. They've come out and said that it hasn't. It's not, but like they're sort of.
No, they didn't.
Oh, they didn't? Oh, okay, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Never mm-hmm. mind. Ethereum might be a security. So like we focus on Bitcoin for a number of reasons, right? The first reason is that, like, I happen to think that this is the only part of the asset class, like of digital assets, that is worthy of owning it at all. But that said, too, right, there actually are compliance risks to owning altcoins, and we want to steer clear of that stuff. That doesn't necessarily mean that if a client comes to you and they said, "I bought Dogecoin, what do I do about it?" that you shouldn't talk to them about it. But like, I mean, you could say, "I don't have an opinion on it," but probably your answer should be sell, or we don't really advise on that. But Bitcoin, there you can advise on that. You could put it in your ADV. There's no problem with that about their risks associated with owning Bitcoin. And with the exception of that, if you're not advising on unregistered securities, you're allowed to advise on it just like you tell somebody how much house they can afford.
Or how many bananas they can buy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a commodity.
Yeah.
Type thing. Okay, the compliance, obviously the accounting is the same as property.
Yeah, the accounting is the same as property. The exchanges have not caught up to the way that the custodians in the fiat world have it all done. So I would say that it's really important as an advisor, especially if your client's going to go off to like Coinbase or Kraken on their own and go buy some shares. That's just like
sats.
Yeah, some sats that you help them pull. Where they like what their actual price that they bought it at and what their cost basis is. We found that it's extremely difficult after the fact, 3 months later. If you're doing it 3 months later, it's already gone. The data, you have to go pull a report. The report's terrible. The report, I don't understand why they haven't talked to anybody in accounting about what actually needs to be on this report, but they're just like beyond bad from every single one of the exchanges. What we do with clients is right after they buy it, we help them go in there and actually pull their cost basis, and we keep it on a spreadsheet for them. I would say the accounting part of it is going to be extremely important. That way, when it does come time to sell, you have all of your ducks in a row.
Absolutely. Anything else?
Well, if we didn't answer your question, then let us know. We're happy to help answer more questions here. You can also, you could shoot me an email and you could schedule with me. I offer advisor consulting on this subject and on all sorts of subjects about registered investment advisors. So I'm happy to consult with anybody if they have questions.
Excellent. Well, that's a great way to wrap it up. If I think of any questions, I'll ask you next episode.
Okay. That sounds good.
Yeah.
Thanks for hosting.
Yes, come back, Morgan. Come back. We really enjoy having you on the show.
Thank you. On our next episode, you will hear more from Pierre Richard.
Maybe. I mean, maybe we'll get a deluge of questions. Here's another question. Mm. Well, I guess you kind of answered it, but the client that is like, hey, you know, Bitcoin's great, but have you heard of XYZ?
Yeah.
Altcoin.
That actually is going to happen, I think, way more than people are. I think that as soon as you offer Bitcoin as a service in your practice, that opens up the door for clients asking you about XYZ coin or whatever. So I think that the more you educate yourself on what Bitcoin is versus the rest of the space, the easier it is for you to answer these questions, even if you don't know anything about XYZ coin. Just because, like, knowing what decentralization is and why Bitcoin does it the best, why Bitcoin is really the only way that it's possible, and how that helps secure digital money, right, is, I think, the most important thing to know and understand. And once you know and understand that, you can pretty much debunk almost anything else that that somebody comes across with as far as altcoins.
Without having to do much research.
Oh, yeah.
It's really great.
Yeah, it is really great. And I would also say, if you know about Bitcoin's features in general, right, knowing about the decentralization part, knowing what Lightning is and how it works, is going to kind of answer a lot of clients' questions about, if they say slow and expensive, right, that you're like, no, Bitcoin's fast and instant through Lightning. So there are just certain aspects of Bitcoin that if you know them, you can pretty much answer any questions about any altcoins.
Perhaps the challenge is when the altcoin is outperforming Bitcoin.
Yeah, that is always really difficult, I would say. I mean, it, It's just tough. I think sometimes clients have to learn that the hard way, unfortunately. I mean, just like with any market, you're never going to buy the bottom and sell the top. Your client is very unlikely to buy the bottom and sell the top of all the pumps and dumps that happen in the altcoin sectors. So generally what I've found, I mean, I've had a couple of different examples, but I've had clients buy low, but then not be able to sell at the right appropriate time. So maybe they didn't lose money. I think this is kind of actually best case scenario is that they buy low, but they don't sell when they're supposed to. And then it goes back to around or slightly above where they were before.
Buy low, sell low.
Yeah, buy low, sell low. And like, yeah, pay fees and maybe don't lose money or make a little bit. Like that's best case scenario. That's not normally what happens. What normally happens is that they get in during the pump because it's excitement and everyone's talking about the coin. And then they are part of the dump. And it's unfortunately one of those things where as long as, you know, you told them not to, or you at least, you know, warned against it, then you kind of did your duty. But sometimes people have to learn that lesson. And unfortunately, sometimes people have to learn that lesson a bunch of times.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, learning the hard way is one way to learn.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing, though, is that you might have clients who are very open to what you have to say. And I would be cognizant about who's open and who's not. So somebody who's not, right, you warn them and you move on. Somebody who is open, though, take the time to have the discussion, right? Because you might be saving them from something really, really detrimental. And I've been in that situation, too, where we took the time and had the discussion. And after an hour, like just a true call about Bitcoin versus other things, where the client really got so excited about Bitcoin that was ready, and he was ready to allocate way more. So, I mean, I think that like knowing your client sort of helps, but trying to insert yourself when you can and like understanding when a client would be receptive versus when they wouldn't be.
Yeah. Sometimes they're so committed to the idea already. There's no talking them out of it, but yeah, other times it's a great opportunity to get them even more bullish on Bitcoin.
For sure.
All right. Well, we'll chat again soon, hopefully.
Yeah, we will hopefully chat again soon. If you like the show, leave us a nice review. We do read them all, and we're very grateful to all of our listeners. You can find me at Morgan with an E, Rochard, and you can find Pierre at Pierre_Rochard on Twitter. If you want to hear a topic, send it in. We're all ears, and we will talk to you soon.
Thank you all.